This is Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and we are beginning the first of our series in Thursday Reporters Roundtable discussions and look at the big news here in Northwest Indiana of the week. And we have in the studio right now Bill Dolan, who is the county government reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana, and Lakeshore Public Radio Stephen Lattimore is with us as well. He's covered a number of the stories that we'll talk about during the hour. And we'll also have some other reporters on the telephone here. We're having some phone system issues right now, so eventually we hope to be able to bring in Sarah Reese from the Times of Northwest Indiana. And we have Joseph Pete also, the business reporter for the Times, to join us as well. And we hope that by later in the hour, before we finish up, that they'll have a chance as well, if the phones are working, to bring Greg Tejeda, who is a reporter and writer for the Post-Tribune as well. He covers, for the most part, issues that happen in Gary City government and the like, and we will have to bring that on. The topics we're going to bring up today include the upcoming visit by the EPA to, or I should say, the visit by EPA to East Chicago, the upcoming visit by HUD Secretary Carson to East Chicago as well, the West Calumet housing problems there, and Stephen knows much about that too, and we'll also find out more, if we can get with Sarah, about the chemical spill into Lake Michigan that came out from the U.S. steel plant. We'll also take a look, too, on topics like the South Shore Line expansion, some of the latest developments in the news in the past week about that, as well as the Gary Public School District as well. And that's where Stephen can bring us up to date on that and some other topics, too. Bill Dolan and Stephen Lattimore, thank you for joining us in the studio today.
Thanks for having us.
Good afternoon.
And we will have a chance, as we said, to have more reporters on the phone lines here as the system allows us to do so. Well, let's first start here talking about the EPA's visit to East Chicago, and I guess we can talk a little bit too, although Sarah Reese was the one that did the story about the impending visit by the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, Ben Carson. He's going to come in at the request of the lawmakers to visit and see for himself firsthand, as with the EPA chief, Pruitt, about the situation in East Chicago these days. Stephen and Bill, I'll let you kind of start in on this here from what you know from your colleagues and what you have probably checked in as well, too, from the governmental side. What do we stand right now on the issues involving East Chicago?
Well, a lot of people are hoping the biggest thing, they had a big roundtable at Maristar just the other day, sort of talking about some of the issues. There's a strategy group there run by Cheryl Reverend Rivera, and what she's trying to do is educate a lot of the folks. I'm continually surprised by how many people who are in that area don't know a lot of the ins and outs, like about the testing. They need to be tested, about where to get the filters, who, what kind of filter. But it's an ongoing process of educating folks, and they're actually banding together with a number of groups from Chicago to sort of be power in numbers kind of thing. They had a big event in downtown Chicago at the EPA headquarters where they were showing their support for the EPA. The issue is that there's a bill, according to Reverend Rivera, that will actually defund the stuff specifically for the Midwest restoration, and they're trying to make sure that their voices are heard to not do that, because it'll bring relief to what the citizens in East Chicago certainly are having to deal with.
Has there been every discussion over at the Lake County Government Center here in the recent weeks, Bill, talking about the problems in East Chicago? They know they're not going to be able to deal with the lead and arsenic contamination. That's a case for the feds and even, I guess, for the state environmental people. But I'm sure that they probably feel like that they'd like to do something if they haven't done anything already.
Well, they don't have much skin in the game. They are leaving this to the state. I'm sure we'll never know how many millions of dollars are going to have to eventually be spent on this project, but the county isn't going to contribute to that. They'll tell you that they don't have enough money to deal with it. So they can't offer much more than sympathy.
Well, that's the way sometimes, I guess, it turns out to be. We know that they deal have the problems with the housing problems, and Stephen has had a chance to check into a lot of the problems that have dealt with the West Calumet housing project, and I know that you've talked with some people as well, too, Stephen. What have you learned in the days here, and we've had the stories here. This is, of course, Sarah Reese is the one who's had the story in the Times in particular about Dr. Carson's planned visit to East Chicago, I guess at the request of Senator Joe Donnelly and some other people as well to come and take a look at the problems with the housing district firsthand.
Well, it's interesting to actually sit down and talk with some of the folks, get their perspective. I guess there's an idea that people say, well, why don't they just move? Well, it's really not as simple as that. Every place doesn't have to take your Section 8 voucher, and they're finding that out. And according to them, they've had a lot of instances where they set up specific barriers that will bar them from coming in. You have credit issues, and they may be able to apply somewhere. All of a sudden, they get there, and there's these new regulations where they get a check that they can put in to pay for some of the expenses, and then the agency says, oh, no, you have to pay cash now. So all of a sudden now they have to come out of their pocket with all this money. I was talking to the mayor, and he was saying, you know, the issue on the other side is that they've had a year to try and get ready to move, and now at this late date, it's like you should have moved. But again, unless you're sitting in their shoes, you don't know all the particulars that they have to deal with.
We know that a lot of the things that I'm sure that Dr. Carson will be at with told by the East Chicago officials when he comes in to East Chicago that it's going to be a matter that he's going to have more not only help for the residents in particular for the West Calumet housing district, but probably for other related housing districts. I'm sure in East Chicago they may not be involved with directly with the lead contamination, at least that they're aware of. I would imagine that there are probably any number of other places in the city that will have this long-term problem with lead contamination or the like.
Yeah, and the question will be, what exactly is HUD going to be able to do? The question really becomes, are they going to defund HUD as well? Is that the plan? Because certainly the issue with the folks as it relates to the EPA is that I'm concerned whether the EPA is going to even be there, according to them. And those protections that they rely on now, you know, they won't be there. This is their point of view.
We're talking here in the studio with Lakeshore Public Radio Stephen Lattimore, who's covered many of the events that have happened in recent weeks in East Chicago, as well as Bill Dolan, who is the county government reporter for the Times. And we'll have more from him here on some other topics coming up as we continue our business, our roundup, rather, of what's happened here in Northwest Indiana, the major stories that you've probably seen online and in print as well, and what you've heard here on Lakeshore Public Radio, and the people who have reported these, Bill Dolan with the Times, one of those, and Stephen Lattimore from Lakeshore Public Radio, and we'll find out more from some of the other reporters as well, too, around the region that are helping out on some of the stories that are coming up here. Bill, if you will, we know that you mentioned here about the issues involving East Chicago, not necessarily on the county government's radar, so to speak. They kind of feel that they have their own matters to deal with. From the stories that you have had from the county council involving helping out the communities in particular, since they don't have to deal with the particular city budgets, of course, they have a lot of county issues to deal with. We find that cleanup of problems out in Lake County government, or not in county, in government rather, but out in Lake County proper. They have any of the topics come up before county council members about any environmental issues out there that you're aware of?
Not really. County doesn't get much into the environmental game. They handle essential local services like highway, making sure your highways don't have potholes, make sure that stormwater drainage ditches are in good shape. But other than the health department, which does testing of water around public beaches, the county pretty much doesn't get involved in that. Again, it's very expensive proposition that only the state and the federal government have the resources to really deal with.
One of the other things we want to take up involving the environment here, and here again, we have our phone systems are having problems, not necessarily in the building, but we're going to have some problems in getting calls in from our reporters. So we'll take up some other topics as well here in the time that we have Bill Dolan and Stephen Lattimore with us as well. We talk about the environmental issues. We've gotten word here this past week about another beach, a third beach now that has had to close on Lake Michigan because of the spill of some toxic material out of the U.S. steel plant. Sarah Reese was the one in particular who was able to have the most information about this, but we know that that we've had other information come into the newsroom to talk about what the U.S. EPA is going to deal. They're doing monitoring of the toxic chemical spill from U.S. Steel into the Burns Waterway, which is about 100 yards from Lake Michigan in the Portage area. And we understand that, of course, now that this happened earlier in the week, and we know, too, that Indiana American Water Company decided not to use their particular water treatment plant that they have for their intake there in the area. They've shut it down because of the chemical spill, and they're relying on their reserves. But I'm sure that Indiana American Water is probably going to have to find other resources if they haven't already to be able to keep that up if they're starting to run low. Ogden Dunes, people say that the drinking water coming from the plant in Gary, I guess, which is still running well, and that's, I guess, one of their big intakes from Lake Michigan to service the Indiana American Water Company offices in the region as well. So we hope that we'll find out more about that area in particular. And we understand, too, that not only from Indiana American Water, but also that IDEM and EPA and other agencies are going to be keeping the communities here in Northwest Indiana apprised as to how the cleanup or the issue of the spill in particular, how much of this toxic material, and if I can, I'll find in my notes here exactly what it's called. It's a kind of a chromium material, I understand, that got into the water from the tin and the tin-free electroplating lines. So it's wastewater that managed to somehow get into Lake Michigan. I have to find out more about that in particular here. You're listening to Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. We have in our Reporters Roundtable today Bill Dolan with the Times of Northwest Indiana and Lakeshore Public Radio's Stephen Lattimore to talk about some of the big stories of the day. Let's move on to the South Shore Line expansion. And Bill Dolan, I know that it was one of the topics that you have had to cover as not only a reporter who covers the Lake County Council. Let's talk first about what the county council has taken up. There's been some big concern, I know, in recent days, and has come up in some discussions in some of the town councils as well, as to how much the county government as well as the towns can share in the cost of doing the expansion of the South Shore. I think most primarily the plan is, of course, known as the Westlake part of the project, which is the line that comes down from the South Shore south through Hammond and down into Munster and Dyer. Bill, tell us about the discussions that came up at the county council in recent days about all this.
Well, of course, this costs money. About $615 million, it's estimated, it would to construct the 9-mile line between Hammond and Dyer, the Westlake corridor you mentioned, as well as $290 million for debt service, because, of course, they don't have $615 million in their back pockets. They're going to have to borrow it, so there'll be interest to be paid. So in the last couple of years, Congressman Pete Vasklosky talked towns and cities into pledging money on the theory that their residents are eventually going to benefit from this increased public transportation infrastructure. And 14 cities and towns have signed an interlocal agreement along with the county to pledge various amounts of money that all add up to about $4 million a year. This was done within the last couple of years. And this is starting to untangle because the town of Merrillville last month voted to reduce their contribution. What they've been using the money, where they've been getting the money to contribute, would be the income tax that you, I, and all of Lake County's residents and workers pay. We pay 1.5% per year of that, and a piece of that is called economic development income tax, and that is spread out to the cities and towns, and they have pledged to give a percentage of this income tax to the South Shore. In Merrillville's case, it should have been 22%. That's what they signed up for. But last month, they decided that was too much and reduced it to 8%. We're talking about $100,000 or more reduction in the annual contribution that Maryville would make to the South Shore. Well, Congressman Vasilkovsky said that that was a binding contract. They can't get out of it, and they might be dragged into court if this goes on. And Maryville's vote has prompted the city of Gary, its city council members, to talk about a similar reduction. I spoke a couple of weeks ago, excuse me, with Mayor Chris Anderson at Lake Station. Although they have pledged money, they have not paid it yet because, according to him, they're broke. And he too would like to get out from under this. Excuse me. Mm-hmm. And this came up this week in the Lake County Council. Councilman Jamal Washington, who represents the town of Maryville and much of Gary and a few other places in Lake County, was talking about a proposal to reduce Lake County's contribution from 25% of its economic development funds to about 5%, a significant cut. But he withdrew it. He withdrew his resolution because he didn't have the votes, essentially. I talked with some of his council members who said they couldn't support that. They've made a commitment, and they're going to stick to it. So right now, the South Shore is still online to get that $4 million that they need. And they're also, depending on state in contributions from the Northwest Indiana Regional Development Authority.
Hey, Bill, are they just saying that it's too much money? Because as I'm thinking, I'm no expert, but this the idea is that it's going to allow people to come to that area, live in that area, get back and forth to Chicago, generate revenue down the line. What am I missing?
Well, yeah, and that's still the argument. It's not clear why they've had second thoughts, but the argument they're now using is essentially, hey, you know, we've got a lot of more immediate problems
roads,
with
bridges.
Our roads, our bridges, our sewers. We wish now that we had not put so much money in that direction. We wish the South Shore well, but the argument is also made in Maryville that they won't directly benefit from the Westlake Corridor, which of course runs through Hammond, Munster, and Dyer on the other end of the county.
And you know what? I know they got bills to pay, but the question then becomes, well, then why did you get into that agreement?
Yeah, good question. They haven't really addressed that, except to say that they don't really even think it's an agreement. They argue that because not all of the cities and towns have signed it, it's still a work in progress and they can back out. Cedar Lake, East Chicago, Griffith, Hammond, and St. John have yet to sign on to this agreement. So they argue it's not a contract, we've had second thoughts, and we have every right to back out.
So by their read, every municipality in the area would need to sign on?
Yes, all 19 cities and towns in the county, according to their argument. Now, Lake County Attorney John Dull has made the opposite argument that there is a binding contract. Of course, that leads to the question, well, who's going to enforce it? Is the county going to step in and sue Maryville?
Right.
Do they really want to do that? We have an election coming up next year. Why would the county want to, tick off residents of Maryville and their leaders over this matter?
Let me ask you this. How much of this do you think is the fact that these folks in these municipalities realize now, wait a minute, this means that a lot of people are going to be able to come out here and live, and maybe I don't want those people coming out here to live? Is that a part of it, you think?
Well, not in Maryville. The Westlake Corridor would benefit mostly Munster and Dyer, I would think, directly, and possibly Hammond. But it would take many years, I think, for that effect to spread to Maryville, to the east. So my guess is not that it's going to change the landscape so much as I think they just realized we've been talked into a deal that we now regret. I think it's buyer's regret is the bottom line here. Now, the Senate and the House are working on a bill that would not allow Merivale to back out or any of the other communities. They would, in essence, say that if you've made an agreement, you've got to stick to it, and if you refuse to pay your share, it'll be garnished out of revenues that you get from the state.
Mm.
That has passed the House. It has yet to get a Senate reading, but it kind of looks like it's going through.
Yeah.
Okay. We're talking with Bill Dolan with the Times of Northwest Indiana and with Lakeshore Public Radio Stephen Lattimore. The topic we're talking about here on our Reporters Roundtable this time is about the South Shore Line expansion. And we'll take a break and we'll be back to have more discussion here. We'll take a look at some of the other stories of Northwest Indiana in the past week. In the studio, we have Bill Dolan, who is the county government reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And we have Stephen Lattimore from Lakeshore Public Radio, who's covered a number of the stories and looked into details not only for this week, but related topics as well, talking about the issues we had, of course, until we realized we have some telephone system issues in the building. We had some other reporters on the line planned to talk about these other issues and join in the conversation. We'll have to just get them on perhaps next week in the hopes that we'll have everything all taken care of. Let's take a look now at the issue of the latest concerning the Gary Community School Corporation. A lot of the activity involving the Gary schools, of course, long-going financial problems, and much of the issues, and maybe we have to we have had some discussion with a conversation earlier in the week with Dan Carton, who's the State House reporter for the Times, and he had some interesting things to note. He's been keeping track of the measure that has been proposed by Senator Eddie Melton to try to help the school district, and now we have not only the plans that are coming through for the state takeover, the Gary Community School Corporation for the business, and I guess one version, the business and the academic side, and they've kind of lumped in, unfortunately, the Muncie Community Schools, which those folks over there are yelling loud and very, very protesting loudly about being involved in that issue. But let's take a look here, Stephen, from the city government standpoint and what you have seen in the Gary Community Schools. I know you've been in contact with the former superintendent. We're saying former only because Dr. Cheryl Pruitt is on leave right now. But you've had a chance to talk with her and some of her staff members about the issues involving the Gary Community Schools. Tell us what you know.
Well, let me just take it from the state point of view, which is, and you make sure that I'm right on this, Bill. The idea was that they would give them the money, and then they would cede oversight in terms of the financial. But now, as I understand it, it's gone a second step where they are also ceding the academic oversight as well. There'll be a board that will be impaneled, one by the city, one by the superintendent, and then another one from the state, and they're basically handing over all the authority. Now, I know Senator Smith was upset about that, but it's like, you know, they're given a lot of money. There's been years of mismanagement. You don't want to blame the finger at the people who just got elected, but the bottom line is the history is so bad, it's like a credit history. You can't come in and get a car if your credit history is bad. So you got to put these safeguards in place to make sure that you're able to pay off the car. I don't know if that's too simplistic, but Bill, what do you think?
Well, they've got about $100 million worth of debt. They've got plummeting student enrollment. Their testing, their state testing scores are could be better. So they've got problems galore. And as I understand it, if this legislation passes, the state will be calling the shots, both financially and academically. And the state essentially has stepped in because the argument is that the state support of the Gary Community School Corporation, about $7,800 per student, is the highest in Indiana, and yet the results are not good. So despite the locals' complaints that the state has no business running the schools, the state feels that they've paid a lot of money and they're not happy with what they're getting. And here they come.
Do you think that, speaking about the financial support that the state has given, do you think that perhaps there's some concern in Indianapolis as well about all of the loans and the advances that the state has given to the Gary Community Schools, and they want to be at least assured that they'll get some of that money back?
Well, I think that money's gone forever. Of course, Gary has been looking for loan forgiveness that hasn't been offered. But I don't see how Gary is in any position to pay. Mm-hmm. Unless this emergency manager works miracles, I suspect that the state is going to be out that money, and Gary is going to have a very long recovery. Who knows how long this state control will last.
Now, something else, too, to throw into that as well. You talk to people on the Gary side, and they'll say, well, you know, the issue with capping the property tax, the issue with all these charter schools coming in, that's money that's not in the pot. And so then you expect me to buy buses and do whatever I need to do when that money that other municipalities have, I don't have. Plus, you let all these charter schools come in. They siphon money up. They will say that, hey, it's not a fair playing ground.
And that is a valid argument. Gary school revenues, property tax revenues, are down, and charter schools have siphoned off a lot of students that would otherwise go to the public schools. But Gary, of course, as we know, has multitude of problems, not just in the schools. The population has just dropped. And it's a basket case.
It really is because you're right. Yeah. I mean, on the one hand, what they're saying is valid, but you cannot get away from, what is it, $103 million?
Yeah. In the end, that money is lost, never to be seen again, right. I suspect. And the price for that is going to be this emergency manager to essentially take over, and I suspect they're going to make he's going to be making a series of cuts, closing schools, laying off a lot of people.
And there aren't too many more people there. And just as an indication, what was it, back in March, you had teachers who almost missed a paycheck. Do you know what it's like to go to school as a professional teacher or custodian, whatever? And you might not. There's a question of whether you're going to get paid.
Well, and it wasn't just this last month. It's been going on for more than a year. They've been living hand to mouth.
Right, right.
It isn't just a debt problem. It's also an operational lack of money, and they just don't have it. And this manager's going to have to come in and see how he can cut costs so the teachers get paid on a regular basis.
I'm actually wondering whether there will actually even be any public schools in Gary left.
Well, that sounds pretty grim, but I got to believe that there will be a Gary public school system after this is all over. It's probably going to be a lot smaller, but hopefully the students that it have will get a quality education, mm-hmm. you would think, and would be and attract people into the city. That's one of the big economic drivers, is great schools.
Right.
Gary has to have that if they're ever going to grow their tax base. So this is a basic problem that apparently the state has decided they have to take over.
And on the other side of that, we keep saying this, you can't expect the state to come in and say, okay, you're having problems. Here's a check. Go ahead and take care of what you need. That's, you know, fiscal irresponsibility.
Well, they've been doing that for some time. And as I said, they're not happy with the outcome. Otherwise, we wouldn't be seeing this legislation.
I know in particular that a lot of people and the complaints have come in lately here about the financial manager, the current financial manager, because a replacement hasn't yet taken place. That was going to come whenever the governor signs the bill into law that is going to involve the state even more in the takeover of the Gary Community Schools. The fellow who's up to now is still acting, I guess, as the financial manager for the school district is Jack Martin, who some people have criticized as not being the best choice on the fault of the superintendent and the school board in Gary. They say that Jack Martin had his own problems he brought in, and he's been accused of having a taken the Detroit public schools to its lowest level ever before coming into the job here in Gary. And I know that Now, once the bill is passed and signed by the governor, that the Distressed Unit Appeals Board is going to probably choose their own selection. I'm sure that they probably are not going to put Jack Martin in that position again.
Well, but the question really – I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
The question really becomes, will people ever be happy with anybody who's coming in to make these decisions?
I suspect that whoever the emergency manager is appointed from this legislation will hear a lot of criticism too.
Right. I mean, they're just going to not –
Jack Martin, of course, may have his faults, but mm-hmm. the problem is that he can only advise. He can only give advice. He can tell them to do this and that, but it's still under local control, which I am assuming is why the General Assembly has decided to take it a step further to having the state come in and call the shots.
And one of the things, too, to look at as it relates to that is just here recently the school board had this issue where they decided to hire back a PR person. The idea was that, listen, we need better publicity. And there was an uproar about it because you got teachers who are missing paychecks, but you're going to hire a PR person. It may be that you need good publicity, but is that the best idea? And they actually went back on it and said, no, we're not going to do that now. But then you see a move like that, and it's like, what are you guys doing?
Well, probably the worst criticism that the school system could have received is from the voters. There was a referendum recently that failed. They were begging the voters to give them the money to avoid the state takeover, and that didn't happen.
I guess now the plan is to try and go back at that, but, you know, I don't know how... I don't know if the voters are in the mood for that.
They'll have to have a better product to sell if they do go before the voters, and I assume that's what the state is trying to help produce.
We're talking with Bill Dolan with the Times of Northwest Indiana. He's the county government reporter and has kept track of some of the other important stories in Northwest Indiana that we're bringing up here in our Reporters Roundtable today. Stephen Lattimore from Lakeshore Public Radio has covered many of these topics that have involved the Gary Community School Corporation and the problems that the Gary Community School Corporation is dealing with financially. And we now know, of course, now that the State House is going to be the focus with the measure that is moving through the General Assembly. In the days that are left before the General Assembly session finishes up here, by the end of April, we'll know more whether the bills that have been proposed to make it through the chambers and if they have to go to conference committee, if there are some changes made in that. And, of course, all would come before Governor Eric Holcomb for his review and a signature or a veto, depending on how he chooses to do it. But I would imagine that with all the problems that the Gary Community School Corporation has, if the bills had been crafted properly, which apparently even in the initial stages have done pretty well. There are going to have to be some tough decisions that the governor would have to say, yes, we'll have to go along with this measure. And in the hopes that the changes that can be made will be ones that the Gary Community School Corporation can live with. And not only the taxpayers in Gary, but the families in Gary that send their youngsters to the public schools will have to deal with as well, too, I would imagine. You're listening to the Reporters Roundtable here on Lakeshore Public Radio on Regionally Speaking. And we should mention that we hope to have more reporters involved. We hope to have many more reporters involved in the discussion today. And unfortunately, our phone system not working well, getting around the problem. So, and I certainly have to sincerely thank Bill Dolan for going in and putting in a yeoman's job and even more so of a job for helping us look at some of these stories, the ones that he has definitely covered as a county government reporter and some of these other related topics as well. And to Stephen Lattimore from Lakeshore Public Radio for going into more detail about some of these stories that he has worked on and kept an eye on as well, involving East Chicago, and as we just now finished talking about the Gary Community School Corporation. And Bill, thank you very much for spending time with us. We really appreciate you coming in and putting in your side of the story that you have covered. And we didn't bring up other topics, which I know that have come up in the news as well recently, and maybe not this week, and we can probably bring into that as well, too, some of the discussions that you happen to come in contact with. One thing in particular, and I know the stories that worked on here, in fact, we have coming up here, we can go into more detail in future programs, is the issue of the Lake County Jail. We know that they're still working under a federal Justice Department scrutiny. And now, I guess, one of the topics that has come up, at least recently, Bill, in the jails decided that they're going to do some more, I guess, thorough testing of the people coming in through what's called the intake system, as well as the jail population, dealing with, I guess, in a side dealing with the opioid problem in Northwest Indiana, and dealing with whether inmates happen to have been carrying the virus that causes AIDS. Or causes HIV, rather, and the issue of other type of diseases that they probably have brought in here. Recall the information coming from the sheriff's department. Can you recall and tell us more about what the sheriff is doing and the sheriff's department is doing within the county jail and dealing with trying to make sure that there are little safer conditions for the prisoners there?
The jail has been under what is, in essence is a federal mandate for the last 8 years. A number of inmates committed suicide. There were contagious disease outbreaks. And the Department of Justice stepped in and declared that the inmates' civil rights were being violated by conditions in the jail. So for the last 7 years or so, we have seen an uptick in the spending on health care. Much more medical, much more psychological care is being provided for the inmates. The estimate is that 60% of them walk in the door with medical and psychological issues, very often caused by drug abuse. And, of course, communicable diseases, like you just mentioned, are part of that issue. And also, we've had a spike in overdoses of heroin and what have you, other kinds of painkillers. And Lake County Coroner Marilee Fry said she spoke yesterday with the sheriff and with Dr. Forgy, who's the medical director in the jail, about what they can do to help stem this, because a lot of the inmates who have come through the jail are going to be leaving. It's only a temporary measure that they're there, and the hope is to catch them before they leave and make sure that they aren't going to become part of those grim statistics of drug overdoses. So I'm sure there will be counseling and education provided by the medical staff to those who are about to bail out or have completed what short sentences that they've received in the jail.
Well, thank you very much for that, and I appreciate the information. And thank you, Bill, once again for coming in here and talking about the stories that you've covered and the topics that you cover on a daily basis there, in particular with the Lake County government. And Stephen Lattimore, thank you very much for being with us and bringing us up to date on the topics that you have as well covered for Lakeshore Public Radio. You've been listening to our first version of the Reporters Roundtable on this Thursday here on Regionally Speaking. Once again, it's time to showcase the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore landmarks, places that maybe you've seen if you've gone by the lakeshore and taken a look at these beautiful houses. Actually seen them if you have not done so before. This is the second year for what is being called the Logs to Lustrons Tour. It's being put on by Indiana Landmarks. And with us to talk about this, we have the director of the Northern Regional Office of Indiana Landmarks, Todd Zeiger, with us. Todd, thanks for being with us here on Regionally Speaking today.
Good morning. Thank you for the invite.
Well, tell us, if you will, a little bit about Logs to Lustrons, how the tour project got started. This is the second year, I understand, for the tour. So obviously had great success from last year's first event.
We did. We sold out last year, and so this year we're actually expanding it, which is exciting. We've added a lecture on Friday night to give folks an opportunity to learn more about this century of architecture in the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore. And with that lecture, if you come to that, you actually get a tour for one of the days on Saturday or Sunday this year. So we're excited to invite folks over to the dunes and let them experience this over 150 years worth of architecture within one national park, a very interesting opportunity.
That's amazing, because people don't realize that there's that much history that is involved in the national national lakeshore itself, particularly with these homes that have been built there. How do these houses, regardless of the type of architecture they are, how do they end up getting there?
Well, it's very different in each one. Most of them were built in their location. So settlement, people built the early houses, the logs, as part of this Logs to Lustrons. Other houses were built later on through the years as second homes or beach homes. Everyone's familiar with, of course, the Century of Progress houses, which were moved there. And so that's really part of the fascinating story at the Dunes, is this sort of combination of buildings that were built in the location along with this unusual development that happened by moving houses across the lake from Chicago. And that's part of the fascinating story that we see and really enjoy telling folks as they come over.
One of the other things that is on the tour, I understand, is a chance to take a look at some very unique Swedish landmarks. Tell us about how they ended up there on the property.
Well, the Swedish settlements were some of the earliest settlers there at the Indiana Dunes, and so it's a history that people may not be familiar with. They get a chance to see some of that log construction, that interesting tenon and joinery that is part of these Swedish homesteads, these Swedish log structures that is unique to that area. So mm-hmm. they'll see that trademark construction in those log homes that represent the earliest part of the settlement of that area by European settlers. And then also, Native American and earlier settlements as well, talking about that prehistory part of the sites will be part of the conversation as well.
You were talking about the homes had been part of the Century of Progress display that was at the Chicago World's Fair that got physically moved from Chicago on the lake all the way over to the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore area. One of the houses that I understand is on the tour is probably one of the most visited, I suppose, of all of them. Tell us about the House of Tomorrow and some of the other houses that people can check out on the tour as well, too.
Recently, the National Trust came into partnership with the Indiana Landmarks and named the House of Tomorrow a national treasure, a program of theirs that recognizes highly significant but endangered properties across the United States. So we're so thankful to have the National Trust as a partner now, and Landmarks is raising $2.5 million to restore the House of Tomorrow. And so as part of that effort and to encourage folks to help us in that fundraising, we're going to have the House of Tomorrow itself open as part of the Logs to Lustron tour. It was not open last year, so this is an addition this year to let folks see the house and see what the plans and vision for it are.
Now, for people that are not necessarily familiar with the House of Tomorrow, tell us what that is and why it seemed to be, certainly at its time, we're talking back, of course, in the 1930s, why it was so futuristic.
Yeah, people have to put your hat on. What were folks living in 1933? Of course, bungalows or maybe an old Victorian house. And so this 12-sided glass House of Tomorrow that George Breck Heck designed was really out there for folks when you put that hat on. And so you have this 12-sided house of glass, this House of Tomorrow that showed an airplane hangar and a car and a dishwasher and electrically operated doors and, dimmable lights and all kinds of futuristic things was built in the Century of Progress and then moved over to where it's at now. And the vision is to restore that Keck design as he had it. It was very, very influential in modern design, and we want to return this house to its rightful place in architectural history and predating many of the other houses that are kind of commonly associated with early glass homes, Philip Johnson's house and Farnsworth House, of course. And here you have House of Tomorrow, 1933, all-glass house, very futuristic if you think about what folks were living in at the time.
Well, and certainly, too, it's a perfect place to be able to go look at that house, a great spot to have brought that house over from Chicago right there on Lake Michigan, a beautiful view and an opportunity to take in all the nature that you can gather with your eyes there on Lake Michigan and surrounding you as well, too. You just get the 360-degree view, I suppose, or you can, I guess, just walking through the house.
Once it's restored, yeah, we get those 10-foot sheets of glass on those upper floors and the outside inside once that's completed. And that's definitely the vision for it. If you can imagine standing in the living room, you'd be able to see 360 degrees around you at the national park and the lake and actually be able to see on clear days where the house originally was built. You can see the Chicago skyline and where the Century of Progress general area in the skyline was built. So it's kind of a unique opportunity to be able to stand in a house and see where it was built first and be surrounded by history.
We're talking with Todd Zeiger, who is the Northern Regional Director of Indiana Landmarks, about the second now annual Logs to Lustrons tour. It's going to happen on May 13th and May 14th. And as you mentioned earlier, Todd, that not only are the tours involved in this weekend of events, but also some speeches as well, some talks. Tell us about some of the discussions that are going to happen. I understand you're going to participate in one of them.
The lectures Friday evening, the 12th, will be an opportunity for folks to get more in-depth. So during a tour, you can give lots of great information and you can see the sites, but just because of the nature of those, they're limited. And so we thought if folks wanted to get more depth in this, you know, century and a half of architectural history, we're going to talk about that in more detail, show some more of the history of where this architecture came from, and specifically also be speaking about the influence of House of Tomorrow and how it impacted future developments along with the other Century of Progress houses themselves. And so the lecture on the 12th is an opportunity for those who want more depth than you can get on the tour to come and learn about that and then take the tour the following day and actually see the sites.
Once again, it's Logs to Lustrum's tour. It showcases 12 sites spanning over a century, more than a century, actually, of architecture in the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore. It's going to happen on May 13th and 14th. And Todd, how can folks get tickets to be able to take advantage of not only the tour, but the lectures as well?
It's go to our website, which is indianalandmarks.org. That's one word, plural, indianalandmarks.org, and look for the link for Logs to Lustrum. And you can get your tickets. I would encourage folks to do that sooner than later, as we did sell out last year, and we expect a good turnout this year. So I would encourage folks to get their tickets and come out and support that and see the vision for the House of Tomorrow and support the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore, a great place to go hang out in May and see some wonderful architecture.
Now, Todd, can you recall from last year, the first year that they had the tour up, how quickly the tickets went? When did you finally sell out?
We sold out within about a month of the tickets going up, and so we've been online now with this one for a couple weeks, but adding a second day will be helpful so that folks can plan their day, figure out which day is most convenient for them. There's different times to take. All the tours are shuttle, so you'll pick your ticket and pick out which time you want to go during the day. So we expect good interest. Adding some additional times and days we think will be helpful for folks to come out on that weekend and take a look at the tour.
Once again, that's the Logs to Lustrum's tour that is going to be held at the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore. In fact, a dozen sites that are planned to be shown off, and the talks that will go along with that as well, too, to look at all this great architecture spanning from log cabins built by the Swedes, the first settlers in that particular area, all the way up into the houses in the Century of Progress homes that were moved over from the Chicago World's Fair of the 1930s. Todd Zeiger, thank you very much for being with us to talk about this, and we hope that, as you say, get your tickets early. There's a chance to take a great tour, and hope you have a chance to get your tickets before they're all sold out. Once again, for this now second annual Logs to Lustrum's tour, thank you very much for being with us to talk about it.
Hey, we look forward to seeing everybody out there. Thank you for the time.
One note here about the tour shuttles for May 13th and 14th. They will be running every 15 minutes along the route. The tour itself lasts about 2 hours, so this will give visitors out there for the Logs to Lustrum's tour a chance to get off the bus, to explore the area, take a look at the houses, and catch another shuttle bus to continue on the route. And again, more information about the tickets available for the Logs to Lustrum's tour available on the Eventbrite website. The author of a bill that bars local government and communities from banning short-term rentals, such as Airbnb, put a clock on Wednesday on the final negotiations over the controversial measure. Republican State Representative Matt Lehman's bill, as it currently stands, would limit the rentals to no more than 30 days in a row and 180 days total in a year. It would also require the owners to have liability insurance. A proposed update to the bill that Lehman presented at the conference committee on Wednesday would eliminate the insurance requirement and let local governments or local communities now allow for renting only for more than 180 days in a year. Lehman says he is open to other changes, including the creation of a registry for short-term rentals, but he did put a deadline for those proposals.
Come with your ideas by the close of business tomorrow, so we can vet those over the weekend, and then probably Monday, if we don't have any additional suggestions or things that are workable, then we will probably withdraw the dissent and file a concurrence and move the bill as it is now.
Democratic State Senator Karen Talion of Portage says that there is room for compromise, but she says that Lehman's current proposal isn't it.
Anybody can open up an unregulated hotel in an R1 district. And I think that just, you know, does a terrible thing to Indiana's zoning laws.
Now, groups like the Indiana Restaurant and Lodging Association and the Indiana Association of Cities and Towns, now called Accelerate Indiana Municipalities, have also opposed the bill. They believe that local government should maintain control of any zoning decisions, including those that involve such projects as Airbnb. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today and for this week. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. We'll be back with you on Monday.